Hello, and welcome to
Killing It
on Broadway. I'm Jennifer Simard.
And I'm Jessica Vosk, and this is the podcast where we discuss all things guts, gore, murder, and mayhem.
It's not safe for work. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Jennifer. Well, listen, as many of our killers have already gathered, we here at Killing It on Broadway are not only interested in the psychology of serial killers, psychopaths, and sociopaths, oh my, we are also very intrigued by religious organizations, cults, and the individuals who lead them, as well as those who are recruited. Now, you recently heard from our friend Sarah Edmondson, former member of the Nexium cult, which she publicly exposed and took down earlier this year. Guffaha.
Guffaha.
Guffaha. Mm-hmm. And today, as another special episode, we are highlighting the story of Heaven's Gate.
Yes, we are. And in order to do that today, we are joined by some pals. You may know him on Twitter as @annoyingactorfriend, screenwriter Andrew Breedis, along with his wife, Broadway TV actress and choreographer, Sarah Jenkins. Welcome, guys.
Hello.
Thank you so much for having us.
I'm very, very excited.
Very excited. Big fans of you both and this as well.
We also, such as well, are fans of yours. And little known fact, children of the corn, Andrew Breedis and I went to college together at the Hart School of Music /University of Hartford. While he went ahead and did the right thing and finished his degree,
No, I didn't.
He did not finish his degree.
I didn't. I just went a few more semesters than you.
Look at us. Oh, it makes me feel so much more better. I left after one semester, but I basically like fell in friendship love with Andrew. And look at this full circle shit.
Yeah. Like we had one semester together, and there's like maybe like five people I'm still really in close contact with on a regular basis since that time. And you're one of them. I went six semesters. I only had five extra semesters of student loans to deal with. So I went through my junior year.
Wow. Okay. Well, See, I mean, but at least you went those other extra steps.
It counts for something, I'm sure, right?
Of course it does. I mean, it counts for something, you know, you're going to heaven. Skate. Get it?
Yeah.
Thank you guys so much for coming. Thank you.
And the three of us, Andrew, Sarah, we've been on vacation together a few times.
Oh, parties together.
Sarah's taking photographs of me.
We've done all the real life fun things that you could do at one point.
Old friends.
Oh, life.
And in fact, Andrew, I don't know if you know this, Jessica. You've heard me talk about the story how I went to a screenwriter friend to give me some notes on something that I was writing related to this field. And that's around the day that I was like, oh, I think I actually want to do a podcast. Well, that friend was none other than Andrew.
Oh,
so in a way, you're part responsible for this podcast. So thanks, Andrew.
I'm taking ownership for all of the work that you've done on this.
Terrific.
All of it.
I love that.
Now, Andrew and Sarah, you grew up approximately 15 minutes from where this happened. Is that correct? Or one of you was closer? Andrew's closer, but...
Yeah, San Diego County is quite large. And so I was in what's called, otherwise known as North County, which is just before you get into like Camp Pendleton and start heading towards Orange County. And this was in a town called Rancho Santa Fe. And I was about 15 minutes from Rancho Santa Fe in a town called Carlsbad. But I was basically in the center of kind of where this cult was frequenting at that time. Mm-hmm. And Sarah is from...
I'm also from San Diego, but it's huge. So I'm from Southeast San Diego.
Oh, boy.
I know.
Watch out for those girls.
You can see the mountains of Mexico from my parents' house. That's how far south we are.
Amazing.
It's still good old San Diego. Hometown cult realness.
Haha. Well, thanks to the internet sleuthing of Andrew and Sarah, killers, they found one of the waiters who served the 39 cult members their last meal at a local Marie Callender's. And we have a portion of that interview for you here today. You can also find the interview in its entirety on our Patreon page. But we cannot thank you guys enough for doing that, for being our little helpers. And we also thank the waiter in question, Dave Riley. This is so fun. Thank you for doing that.
It was such a treat. I mean, also, we've always been obsessed with this. My whole family, my sister Meg actually was the one that did the good internet sleuthing and found him. Andrew sent him the email, and he could not have been cooler to just engage and thrill us with all of our dumb questions that I've had since I was a kid, truly.
And also, I mean, and also it made me want a chicken pot pie.
Correct.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. The thing that's always, you know, this happened when I was a kid, so there's a lot of details about Heaven's Gate that were either hidden from me by my, you know, my mom at the time, because it was really grim and unfortunate. And one of the things I just never really knew about until in the last couple of years was that they had gone to this Marie Callender's, which is basically a, most people in the country know it as basically a place you get fruit, you get like frozen food in a grocery store that says Marie Callender's on it, but it's really more like a Coco's or a Denny's. It's a chain.
So when they went there, did they go to the Marie Callender's the day of or the day before? When was the date that they went?
They went on March 21st, which was a Friday at 2:00 in the afternoon. And it's believed that the suicides came in three waves over 3 days. So they started a few days later. So the last day was the 26th, which was my birthday. So the 25th, 24th, somewhere around the 23rd, I think, is when they started. So there were a few more days, but this was like the last big thing they did.
They really needed to fuel up.
Fuel up. For
indeed. One must.
The last red carpet event that they did was at the Marie Callender's. Okay.
And all right. Always been interested in this last couple of years. I learned that this was a thing, and that I was like, I have, as a former waiter myself, I have so many questions about this party that came in, and I've always been like, one day I'm going to talk to the waiter of it. And so it was like, when it was a couple of weeks ago, I just kind of started trying to find any name I possibly could, which when you look up Marie Callender's Heaven's Gate, you don't find the names of the servers as often as you just find the general story itself. So I found Dave Riley's name in one of them, and that is, and then Sarah's sister is the one who found his LinkedIn within like 4 minutes. And the second that we sent him the email and like had figured, and he had written back, and he already had a sense of humor. He's like, how the F did you find me? And I was like, this guy's going to be awesome. He's such a cool guy. He's somebody we'd all be friends with. It was just a joy to talk to him.
Amazing.
Now for us, let us dive right in. For everybody who wants to hear about this, particularly like out of this world, pun intended, case, it is something that we only can possibly dream up because it's that crazy. But credit where credit is due. We got our information today from Wikipedia, thesun.co.uk, and actually the Los Angeles Times article, which was written by a professor at University of Illinois. So this is the story of Heaven's Gate. Now, as aforementioned, Heaven's Gate was founded in 1974 and led by a gentleman named Marshall Applewhite. He lived from 1931 to 1997, and a woman named Bonnie Nettles, who lived from 1927 to 1985. Marshall was the son of a Presbyterian minister and a former soldier. He began his foray into biblical prophecy in the 1970s. And after being fired from the University of St. Thomas in Houston over an alleged relationship with one of his male students, he met Miss Bonnie Nettles, a 44-year-old married nurse with an interest in theosophy and biblical prophecy. I mean, who doesn't these days? In March 1972. Now, according to Applewhite's writings, the two met in a hospital where she worked while he was visiting a sick friend there. It's been rumored that it was a psychiatric hospital, but Nettles was substituting for another nurse working with premature babies in the nursery. Now, Applewhite later recalled that he felt as though he had known Nettles for a long time and concluded that they had met in a past life. Now, sidebar here, I've met people like that. Like, you know, when you're like, I know you, this is a soul to soul connection. Like we go back somehow, and somehow I'm supposed to know you. That I think is valid.
Concur.
Okay, cool. So now she told him she must have agreed. And she said that their meeting had been foretold to her by extraterrestrials.
This is where that whole theory of I stray from that.
The shark jumps fast.
It just jumps so fast from, I feel like we've met and you're a soulmate of mine too, but it's because I've been told by aliens.
Well, you know, they must have seen E.T., Sarah.
Okay, fine.
I mean, just saying, if somebody was like, look, I met a little man from above, and he happened to be friends with E.T. and rode in my bicycle. I mean, that seems to be like, Miss Nettles worked at a psychiatric hospital, but she might have needed the psychiatric care. But we're just so she says that the extraterrestrials persuaded him that he had a divine assignment, which sounds just so charming, doesn't it? And it's something, would it impress all of you? I guess this is my question to my three cohorts here, which now Jen and I always say this to our friends who come on the show. We are at this point like doctors of cults. So now the two of you are under the umbrella of Dr. Briatus, Dr. Jenkins.
Oh, yeah, we know. Now we know it all.
You know everything about ET and cults. And my question is, would you be impressed to hear that an extraterrestrial came down and said, "You're Jesus"? I mean, would that be impressive to you?
I guess I would be a little honored, but mostly the term assignment just puts such utter fear in me. Look, I'm getting verklempt right now because the entire idea of schoolwork is still so terrifying to me that I think if ET said, "I have a celestial assignment for you," I'd be like, "I'm flunking out. I'm sorry. I can't do it.
The pressure.
Too much pressure. I think if you came to me and said I had to do this, I'd be like, okay, but like I have planned out the next five meals and this seems like a bigger deal.
Right,
and I would have a panic attack.
Andrew
for like five
basically
minutes.
Would be like, "I understand my celestial mission, but you need to tell me when I get the snacks."
Yeah.
Okay.
And then once I work that out, I'd probably be cool with it. Because one thing they would talk a lot about with these lots of these cult conversations that are coming up is that how it can happen to anybody. And I get that and I see that. At the same time, I feel like leading a cult is something that could happen to me.
No, but we're in the same boat. When we talk,
she's
to
rolling
our friend,
her eyes so hard.
No, I mean she's rolling. Listen, and for our listeners, you know, you don't get to see these interviews because we don't video record them. But yeah, first of all, when Sarah said she was verklempt, she sort of pulled her skin back in a very Botox way, which for me, you know, for me, I love that. And and now, you know, as Andrew said, he could possibly, you know, he understands how this happens. She did an eye roll. And Jen, mm-hmm. And yeah. would you be impressed to hear that ET came down and said, "Hey, girl"? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think tagging on to what Sarah said, when I hear the word assignment, and now that you've been my business partner for 4 months, Jessica, I'm sure you're going to absolutely agree with me. When I hear assignment, my Hermione Granger kicks in.
It sure
does. Right. So even though I would hate it and maybe not like this particular assignment, you can bet I would burn the midnight oil just getting it done. I got to get that A. I have to be the front row. My hand is up. What do you need? Jesus? Okay, I can do that.
Sure. That is a Jen Simard specialty and she does it. Let me tell you something. She does
it. It's more like a GT, like a Jesus ET combo platter.
Oh my God. Look at us are rolling. We are improving new ideas here, guys. This is why we have our two special guests today.
That's what my doctoral thesis on cults would be about. It would be about GT.
Right. Well, we really do appreciate you both because you are like our field reporters. Wouldn't you say, Jessica? They're out in the field.
I certainly would. I would liken it to, you know, somebody who was covering a tornado for us in Kansas.
But this is for
us. Now, as we keep going forward, because we need to tell this story, that these two are two, you know, mainstays and beginners, founders of Heaven's Gate. They started reading several philosophic books. They dove into the New Testament and they focused on many different religious teachings over the course of their new friendship. And after some of this time researching together, I would say probably a couple months, Applewhite and Nettles' beliefs had solidified into this basic outline. Now they concluded they'd been chosen to fulfill biblical prophecies and they had been given higher level minds than other people. Now, everybody get ready for this next little part because these are the things that I was saying before that seem hard to believe when you hear them. They wrote a pamphlet that described Jesus's reincarnation as a Texan, a thinly veiled reference to Applewhite. And furthermore, Jen's laughing. Everybody, Jen's laughing.
Well, it's just
Sarah's also. Everybody's laughing.
It's also such. Listen, my husband's.
You guys are being
mean. No, my husband's from Texas. The man I nearly married is from Texas. Now I have in-laws from Texas and some best friends from Texas. But of course, Texas, they do think they're just better than everybody. You know, it's Texas. Right?
Everything's bigger, baby. Everything is bigger than Texas, including Jesus's reincarnation. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But talking about this reincarnation, it was a thinly veiled reference to Applewhite. Like, the, you know, he is. the Jesus. And they concluded that they too were the witnesses described in the book of Revelation. And occasionally they visited churches or other spiritual groups to speak of their identities, often referring to themselves as, quote, the two, or, quote, the UFO two. And they believed they would be killed, then restored to life, and, in view of others, transported onto a spaceship. This event, which they referred to as the demonstration, was to prove their claims. And to their dismay, and everybody's throwing up air quotes now, like Jen just threw up some air quotes. Sarah just did this like chuckle, which probably Andrew felt. It looked like it was a vibrating chuckle. And that's why this is so insane. The ideas, here we go, y'all. Can you believe that their ideas were poorly received by religious communities when they went to go
Shocking.
Speak?
Shocking. I'm outraged, in fact. Outraged. I mean,
who knew that they'd go across all of these groups they spoke to about who they were, all of the things that were going to happen to them as far as being taken up by a spaceship. People went, well, I don't really think that that's a true story. And I think that seems a little bit cray cray. However, these two stood their ground. They hustled. They did their little, you know, what I like to call squirrely hustle that I identify with. And they kept their statement very much going within their community. And eventually, Applewhite and Nettles resolved to contact extraterrestrials and continued to seek like-minded followers. They published advertisements for meetings where they recruited disciples, whom they called, quote, the crew. And at the events, they purported to represent beings from another planet called, quote, the next level, who sought participants for an experiment. And they stated that those who agreed to take part in the experiment would be brought to a higher evolutionary level. And in 1975, during a group meeting with 80 people in a Studio City home, they shared their simultaneous revelation that they had been told they were the two witnesses written into the Bible story of the end times. You're welcome.
You know what? That was so excellent.
Well, I just love that, of course, they were the two witnesses, because it reminds me of people who believe in reincarnation. That's great. But have you ever noticed that no one says they're reincarnated as plumber number seven? They're always, I was the seventh Earl of, they're all royalty. You know, no one's just the third girl from the left.
Everyone's for sure.
Right?
No, I'm pretty sure if I was reincarnated, I would be like the rabbit that exists for a few months and then gets hit by the car. Like, I just know that I wouldn't get anything cool.
I'd be the octopus in my octopus teacher. Like, for anybody who's watched my octopus teacher, when they're like, the octopus only lives a year and she's hunted by all the sharks, and that bitch is like, you know what I mean? That's what I would come back as. Mm-hmm. I completely know it at this point. Mm-hmm. The anxiety of it all. Like, oh, she, you know, somebody bit her leg off. Well, let's grow it back. Yeah. You know, it's...
I'd also like to just take a quick moment to acknowledge that I know that I'm probably a terrible person, but I feel really excellent to be surrounded by like-minded, terrible people right now, because as you are reading that, you know, manifesto essentially that they had, I cannot stop laughing. Like, it also brings me such unbridled joy to hear the story of these cuckoo cuckoos that thought they were going to beam up to space. And that's terrible. Like, these people killed themselves, but it just makes me giggle. I mean, as a kid, I had a Marshall Applewhite sticker on my closet door for probably 15 years. You know what I mean? Until I eventually cleaned my room. I was a dark child.
I had one of Patrick Swayze, but it's like, it's almost, and so, but that's
I did.
Not the same.
I mean, I didn't love him. It was mostly just like, I thought it was so funny. And that's, now as an adult, I realize that that's really dark and horrible, but I still giggle. Like, I watch these documentaries about Heaven's Gate and the thought of your final meal being a turkey pot pie and then just committing mass suicide wearing, wait for it.
Oh, she's holding up the Nike. You guys, she's wearing the Nikes.
Black Nikes.
Black with the white stripe, the white. Oh,
They had to retire those Nikes. It was like the Ford Bronco. Yeah.
Killing It on Broadway is proud to support A-Step, artists striving to end poverty. This organization was started by our friend Mary Mitchell Campbell, musical director of Broadway and beyond, who also wrote our theme song, Killing It.
As we all know, the arts are in a challenging time right now in the U.S., and A-Step has been doing innovative things during this pandemic.
including feeding thousands of families, as well as bringing the arts to children. If you are able, please go to astep.org to make a contribution to the Arts Resilience Fund so they can keep killing it by bringing smiles to the faces of children everywhere.
That's astep.org. Thanks, killers. Here's Jen, get us back, Jen.
I'm going to get us back.
Sorry.
Yes, ma'am. All right. So here we are now. It's 1975, where there were a decent amount of followers behind Applewhite and Nettles. They assembled at a hotel in Oregon, sold all of their worldly possessions, and lost touch with any family or friends. And this is a theme, wouldn't you say, Jessica, that we have in cult life, that we find in cult life, it seems. Yeah.
Yes.
So many people wondered what happened to these people. CBS Evening News' Walter Cronkite even reported on the disappearance of this large group, asking if they took a trip to eternity or if they were somehow just taken and kidnapped. Truth be told, Applewhite and Nettles had arranged for the group to go underground. From that point, Doe and T, as the two now call themselves, led the nearly 100-member crew across the country, sleeping in tents and sleeping bags and begging in the streets. Evading detection by the authorities and media enabled the groups to focus on Doe and T's. I love Doe, a deer.
It's tea,
drink with jam and bread. I just
it's
can't
true.
Get it out of my head.
But did you, you know that that's what they named it after? Like, they said that she had such a fascination with the sound of music. That's literally why they chose those names. You'll never hear the song the same again.
I think he did too.
Oh my,
They have parody. They did like a talent show. You can find a video of them singing Do Re Mi, but it's two new lyrics about Do and T. It totally changes the way you view sound music.
I can't get it out of my head. So they enabled the group to focus on Do and T's. I know you're all thinking of the music. Do and T's doctrine of helping members of the crew achieve a higher evolutionary level above human, which they claim to have already reached. Applewhite's writings, which combined aspects of millennialism, Gnosticism, and science fiction, suggest he believed himself to be Jesus's successor and the present representative of Christ on earth. Yeah, me too. Doe and T taught during the religious movement's early beginnings that Doe's bodily vehicle was inhabited by the same alien spirit which belonged to Jesus. Likewise, T, in other words, Nettles, was presented as God the Father. Should we be doing this type of branding for our future careers? Andrew, Sarah, Jess, anyone? What do you think?
I would love it. I feel like I would get a lot of followership more. So, and I just think people would really be into that for me if I said all of a sudden, like, hi, I'm also God the Father. Like, let's have a time together. Like, let's have a couple baby back ribs and maybe a milkshake on a Sunday. Like,
I'm signing up. I want to go to that Last Supper. Consider me a disciple.
Yeah. Branding is important.
It is. But Jessica, that would be your experience. And I just know my luck. I would be burned as a heretic. Like, meanwhile, you'd be raised up and I'd be on a stake. Just heresy. Right? That's my lot in life.
Yeah, they would be, she follows the witches of Eastwick. Yeah, I'm with you. I get it.
I mean, someone has to take the fall, Jen.
Yeah. No, she is. She's Bugs Bunny. I'm Daffy Duck. That's all there is to it. Okay, now, in any cult, you hear about how much they focused on recruitment, and Heaven's Gate was no different. Toward the end of the 1970s and the early 1980s, the membership grew as the branding became more about the cult of personalities. Oh, cult of personalities. I don't know anything about that these days in politics. Anyway, cult of personalities, individualism, and alternative religious experiences. It made people feel like they could merge together despite having different religious views. Members took a vow of celibacy, and some were said to have invested upwards of $60,000 to join. Many of Applewhite and Nettles' crew hailed from these very diverse backgrounds. Most of them are described by researchers as having been longtime truth seekers or spiritual hippies who had long since believed in attempting to, quote, find themselves through spiritual means and combining faiths. As recruit numbers grew in its pre-internet days, the clan of UFO followers all seemed to have in common a need for communal belonging in an alternative path to higher existence without the constraints of institutionalized faith. This recruitment happened through the mid-80s. They landed at 200 members before they pared down. Quick sidebar, you guys. One thing that is fascinating to me about this cult, about Nexium that we just watched, is how it all happened 2 seconds ago.
Oh, yeah. It's now. And I think that's what's so fascinating about it is you think, oh, well, back, you know, years ago in a different time, I can see how somebody might have believed that. Mm-hmm. But you think this is now.
Yeah,
and with all the information that's available to us, you can still think this is the answer.
You can go on Instagram right now and look up hashtag VWeek 2017 and see the Vanguard Week's photos that are not taken down, like from Nexium, all those things that people don't take them down because nobody's looking for that hashtag. Like that stuff is like right there. It's happening right there. I mean, even this stuff with like the Star of Bethlehem that's happening right now where the two planets are like, you know, first time in like 800 years. I kept thinking, like, you know, something's happening somewhere similar to Heaven's Gate. It won't be a mass suicide, but like there's something happening right now that we will watch a true crime docuseries on Netflix about in 5 years.
Oh, yeah. And people still, I mean, I always think about this too. People still are avid followers of the teachings of Nexium. People are still avid, you know, followers of the Heaven's Gate teachings. I mean, there are people out there who continue to be major proponents of these teachings. And you're right. Everything is so at our fingertips, very, very present. And when we had our interview with Sarah Edmondson from Nexium, she said the same thing about, you know, what you just said, Jen, about people wanting to find themselves. It's somebody saying, I think I have a higher purpose. I don't feel fulfilled in what I'm doing. How do I find the right people? And it just happens to be that she landed in this group that nobody thought was a cult until they knew it was a cult.
Yeah. And to go to Andrew's point earlier, no one joins a cult. No one sets out to, you know what, I'm going to join a cult. They think they're joining something else.
A religious group, an experience, you know, I mean, Heaven's Gate, culty from the beginning.
I was going to say that one was pretty straightforward. They weren't cloaking it in, we're going to give you tools in which to operate a better business. They were straight up like, hey, y'all, we join us and we get to turn into aliens. Whoop, whoop.
The thing that's so interesting about Heaven's Gate to me that I've learned like later in life is that there wasn't a threatening overpower. There wasn't collateral. You could come and leave when you wanted. They told you you couldn't do this, you couldn't do that, you couldn't do that. But if you needed to just leave, you just could leave. And I find that like the rules within the cult were very strict, like leading in some cases to castration. But at the same time, they could leave.
Yes,
and nobody was gonna post a video of you accusing your family of heinous things. Like that, you know.
Now, as this keeps going, many events have passed in the creation of the Heaven's Gate group and the formation of its core members. Now, but Nettles continued to be the interpreter of signs. She was the mystic of the group. She was the psychic, the knower, the seer. And in 1983, she had to have one of her eyes removed due to cancer. And at the time, her doctor informed her that the disease was already spreading through the rest of her body. She did not listen. She stated that she believed the doctor was very ignorant, and she believed, along with Applewhite, that she couldn't die, as they had to ascend together. Lo and behold, the cancer continued to worsen, and it moved to her liver, and she subsequently died on June 18th or 19th of 1985. Now, Applewhite convinced the rest of the group that her, quote, broken down vehicle was left behind, end quote. And he had her body cremated, and her ashes were then spread upon a lake somewhere in Texas. Applewhite explained to the group that Nettles had left because her work was done on this level, but that he still had more that he had to do. He also said that Nettles would continue to help them from the next level. And it wasn't until her death in 1985 and Applewhite's subsequent revision of the group's doctrines that the crew gained this eventual reputation as a, quote, cyberculture form of religious thought reform. By the mid-90s, I mean, this began in the 70s, y'all, now we're in the mid-90s, the group had become very reclusive, identifying themselves using the business name Higher Source, and now using their website to proselytize and recruit followers.
So before I continue, Jessica, I do want to pitch that we do a CD together called Broken Down Vehicle, an EP maybe, and that like the first song is called Left Behind.
Oh, I was going to say the first song was called Sputter, and it just went me, sputter, 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 sputter.
Right.
I would do the percussion. Oh, no, Alexa. No, no.
Oh,
Alexa, no.
She got very excited. Alexa She's was like, yes, I will play this album. Let me find it.
Yeah, she's really, that was one of the best things that's ever happened.
I could be wrong here, mm-hmm. But I believe HireSource was also the name of their website company, like the company because they
that
were,
is correct.
Yeah, they were on the very like the advent of being web designers, and I did some research on them, and they basically are saying, from what I've read in articles, is that they're like you can't really tell because every website from the 90s kind of looked like garbage unless it maybe had Java or something, but they essentially mm-hmm. weren't doing much better work. They were doing, basically their website sucked is what I learned. They weren't mm-hmm. very good. I was looking at like their original website that you can see on like the Wayback Machine. And it just kind of looks like my GeoCities site that I was making when I was 12. Where it's like, okay, they can do a background and frames. But that's kind of also what a lot of websites looked like back
then. Oh, yeah, hello. Mm-hmm. I mean, early 90s. Like I thought dial-up was amazing. Like I would mm-hmm. sit there on my computer, like let us pray to the higher source that, you know, something will connect for me to get on Instant Messenger.
Right.
You know what yep. I mean? Like that was the time. Of like, let me burn some CDs off of Napster. Whoa. I mean, it was, you know, website.
But, I mean, God forbid if your dad had to like use the fax line.
Oh, how awful. The two separate phone lines, one for the computer. I mean, the kids these days, they just don't know the struggle.
They just don't know. So this next part of the story is really the kind of information that reminds us all of sci-fi films and true mysteries of what cult life really meant for the followers of Heaven's Gate. In October 1996, members of T's clan began renting a large home, which they called the Monastery. It was a 9,200 square foot mansion located near 18341 Colina Norte, later changed to Paseo Victoria in Rancho Santa Fe, California. They paid $7,000 per month in cash, samesies. In the same month, the group purchased alien abduction insurance. How is that real? That would cover.
I want to know what insurance companies was like. Oh, absolutely.
Right. Yes. You guys. Yeah. I need flood insurance. I need renter's insurance. And I need alien abduction insurance.
Wait, well, why were they buying insurance for that? Wasn't that the point? Didn't they want that? Was to be abducted? I'm confused what the insurance was, if it were all, like, what was,
well,
what's it for?
Well, maybe they were afraid the wrong aliens were going to come get them. Do we think?
State Farm, honestly, it was probably Farm. They were like, we are here for you. You know what I mean? Like, in mm-hmm. those commercials where State Farm, like, mm-hmm. you're just sitting at your table and you're like, oh, I spilled a glass of water. And they're like, hi, Jess. You're covered. You know, like, that's yeah. what...
That's what, okay. Well, in any event, this insurance would cover up to 50 members and would pay out $1 million per person. This policy covered abduction, impregnation, or death. Sorry, I can't even read it. This policy covered abduction, impregnation, or death by aliens. No kids. That is, despite my laughter, not a joke. It's not a joke. It's very real.
Now the next thing I need to find is who sold them that insurance, and then we'll do a podcast. We'll do a Patreon episode on that.
Yes. Find them and interview them. Yeah.
Wait, impregnation. Did they get specific? Was it impregnation by an alien?
Yes.
Just making sure.
Yes.
All right. So on March 19th/20th-ish, 1997, Marshall Applewhite taped himself in Doe's final exit, speaking of mass suicide and the only way to evacuate this Earth. After asserting that a spacecraft was trailing
Hale-Bopp Comet, baby.
It works really well if you sing it to the tune of Mbop. You can sing Hale-Bopp, peep-a-dop.
Excellent. Yeah. So Comet Hale-Bopp. And that this event would represent the closure to Heaven's Gate. Applewhite persuaded 38 followers to prepare for ritual suicide so their souls could board the supposed craft. Applewhite believed that after their deaths, a UFO would take their souls to another level of existence above human, which he described as being both physical and spiritual. Their preparations included each member's videotaping a farewell message. These messages have all been archived and are viewable on the HBO Max documentary of Heaven's Gate. They really are gut-wrenching to witness. For those of you who have not had much research time on Heaven's Gate, it remains the largest mass suicide in human history, next to the Jonestown Massacre in 1978. And Andrew and Sarah, again, thank you so much for interviewing Dave Riley. I think now, before we go into the day of, we will go on to this virtual Last Supper that they had and you know, what the day was like at this restaurant.
It was a Friday that they came in. It was busy from what I recall, for sure.
So it was probably a typical Friday would be the Red Hat Lady Society or an occasional mass suicide call.
Right. Yeah, it was that.
It's going to be one or the other. So it doesn't draw too much attention.
It was either the dollar tip and that was it, or people are eating their literal last items of food and smiling while they are eating it. What? Like, actually, no joke. There was some creepy smiles. Anyway.
So go into where you said where they were sat. What was the restaurant layout at the time? And what was, where was there a room?
Yeah.
Or.
So it was two sections off behind the salad bar. It was three booths kind of on the east side, two booths on the west side. And then there were tables in the middle. So it was basically two stations that we had put together. So we had two long tables in the middle. And then Mr. Applewhite was at the northeast booth, which was the biggest in that. So there, of the three, there was one that probably could fit a family at, and then a four up and a four up, and then same on the west side. So that would have been the layout, which was typically what we did. Ugh, we might have dragged in a couple extra tables. You're
giving himself the biggest booth.
Holding court there, I'm sure.
And I only got one good look at him, but it was, again, very memorable. Nobody knew who these folks were when they strolled in, you know? I know that we, you know, anyway, we'll get to that part whenever you're ready.
Actually,
I think I think
are we there?
We are there.
I am riveted. Yeah. I wanna know with that. If you could see the comet in his eyes, let me know everything.
So when did you get wind? Because you didn't see them come in. When did you get wind? There was a thing going on, and that you were going to assist in it.
Yeah. So I think someone probably said, like, "Hey, Dave, can you help run some food?" And I'm like, "Heck yeah." And so I went in, there was a doorway from where I worked at around the front counter into the main kitchen line where the food got put up. And Jeff, who was there, was like, "It's a cult. It's so a cult." And I'm like, "What's going on?" And then Becky's like, "Yeah, take a look." And I'm like, "Well, what do you mean?" She's like, "No, don't go out there and just stare at them." She's like, "Here, take some food out." So they were just off to the exit to the main line. So you just really hooked a right, and I was there. I just remembered they were all sitting down with really eerie smiles. Like, not, I don't want to say they were forced smiles, like someone was making them smile, but these were not natural smiles, in my opinion. They were just looking a little bit too happy for what was going on. I mean, it's a turkey pot pie with no bottom crust. I never liked the turkey pot pie there because it wasn't.
No!
It
has a topper?
The chicken was the best one, and they were massive. They were like this big, but the turkey one was in a ramekin, and there was just crust on top. So anyway, I cut the corner and I'm walking around, and I see folks with all the same haircut, all the same long sleeve untucked plaid shirts.
Oh no, look what I'm wearing today.
Yes.
I didn't know. Sarah's in an
untucked. See, you look fashionable. You look fashionable. These were not.
Dave, I don't know. I also have short hair. I'm getting really nervous right now.
You just need to button up your top.
I'm kidding, really. I'm gonna do it for the remainder of this.
Did not notice shoes. I didn't notice pants, but I think they were khaki color. But just everyone sitting in a row and like hands on the table, not moving. Yes, buttoned up. They were buttoned up all the way to the top.
I buttoned it up.
Like kooky stuff, like hands were on the tables, all in the same place, and they were all smiling and not like moving around too much. I don't remember any conversation.
That was my question. Were they chatty, or were they just kind of awaiting their turkey pot pie?
I think they were just sitting there smiling, and there might have been some quiet plate conversation. And then in the cut off to the left, I did see Mr. Applewhite. Again, he had a presence to him, but I was moving quickly. I just remembered feeling a little creeped out when I did see him, because it was just very strange. Everyone's smiling, very huge smiles, big, wide, bright eyes. And it was just like, man, I got to get out of here.
Okay. Now on to the suicides themselves. To kill themselves, the members took phenobarbital mixed with applesauce or pudding, and they washed it down with vodka. And additionally, they secured plastic bags around their heads after ingesting this mix to induce asphyxiation. All 39 members were dressed in identical black shirts and sweatpants. They were in brand new black and white Nike Decades, athletic shoes, Sarah, and armband patches reading Heaven's Gate Away Team. Each member had on their person a $5 bill and three quarters in their pockets. Now, the $5 bill was to cover vagrancy fines while members were out on jobs. while the quarters were to make phone calls. Cool. So the 39 adherents, 21 of whom were women and 18 men between the ages of 26 and 72, are believed to have died in three groups, as Andrew mentioned before, three groups over three successive days, with remaining participants cleaning up after each prior group's deaths. The suicides occurred in groups of 15, 15, and 9, between approximately March 22nd and Andrew's birthday, March 26th. Leader Applewhite was the third to last member to die. Two people remained after him, and they were the only ones who would be found without bags over their heads, not having purple cloths covering up their top halves. And before the last of the suicides, similar sets of packages were sent to numerous Heaven's Gate affiliated or formerly affiliated individuals and at least one media outlet. Now, once a member was dead, then a living member would arrange the body by removing the plastic bag from the person's head, followed by posing the body so that it lay neatly in its own bed, with faces and torsos covered by a square purple cloth for privacy. And for those who have watched the documentary, I recently watched it. There's footage of this, which is again, a very strange thing to watch. You know, you feel like you're sort of watching something that you shouldn't be watching. It does seem very private, and there are so many of these people, but they're all posed the same way.
I've dance captained a lot, and it's really hard to get that amount of people to all do the same thing. So props to them.
I mean,
I'm the worst. I'm a terrible person.
I'm just giving them a compliment. That comet was flying around the Earth because it was what, the size of a planet or something. It was so large. And I remember on March 26th when they found the bodies. Now, I don't know if the news broke that day, but that was my birthday. We were at a Yield spaghetti factory. I remember going out into the parking lot, looking up for the comet. I was like, where is it? Because I never saw the damn thing. So my question has always been like, how they believed that they would exit their vehicles and then ascend and hop on the comet. But was there any discussion on timing? Because it has to be when the comet is over the longitude and latitude of where we are. Like, I don't understand if you're doing it at 11 a.m. on a Tuesday on March 23rd or 4th and the comet's on the other side of the planet. So many other things I have answers to. Like, I found out that, like, the Nikes were because, like, he liked... Like, I think they were Nikes because, one, they got a really good deal on
That's
them.
Correct.
They were cheap.
What I'll say is this. The identical clothing was used as a uniform to represent unity, right? And the Nikes, quite literally, were chosen because they got a good deal on the shoes. Now, but he was a big fan of Nikes. So everybody was expected to wear the Nikes within the group. And, like, here's another one. Like, apart from the Sound of Music, Nikes, you know, Nike's branding and slogan is just do it. And they pronounced it dough. Like, they were like, just do it. Because.
Yeah. Yes. I learned that lesson. Just do it.
Mm-hmm. And people, you know, that was a thing. I mean, everybody wanted unity within this group, whether it was. And again, I believe that it was difficult for people coming in, or at least for authorities coming in after the fact. And we'll get to this in a second. Was difficult for them to they thought it was all men who had been part of this mass suicide, because one of the rules within the group was that everyone uniformly, you know, women cut their hair. Everybody's haircut was the same. None of you can see Sarah, but Sarah dressed up for this occasion. Like, she really did her hair very much like a Heaven's Gate member would, and is wearing a very buttoned up celestial shirt, which could be unisex. And that's how they dressed in Heaven's Gate. It was a very much uniformed thing. But then at the end of the day, the part which makes it so funny, slash why SNL and everybody did these characters, is because you have these uniform outfits, but then you have somebody being like, I got a good deal on Nikes, and just honestly say, just do it. And that's what makes it unbelievable.
Like, there's so blatantly consumerism about it.
Yes, there's a Vanity Fair article that says this is the most American thing that could have possibly happened.
And to circle back to Jen and Jess, basically, I think what we've learned from this is it's all about branding.
Hmm?
Yeah.
Hate to say
Jessica,
it,
Jessica, I would like to see if Nike would want to be a sponsor of this show because it throws them in such a good light. And Marie Callender's, for that matter.
The Marie Callender story ends tragically also, as far as if we're talking about structures where these things took place, we'll get to in a minute. But my question really honestly as well has been a new question that's popped up is where did the purple cloths come from, like Joanne's fabric? Like, where did they get the, did they go and said, I need 300 yards of purple cloth, and who cut them?
I mean, honestly, did they go to Mood Fabric in New York? Yeah, I mean, are they the ones that kept Mood open? Yeah, that's right, baby.
Right, make it work, you guys. Make it work.
I mean, but it's true. It's like you're right. There's all of these little nuts and bolts of the entire mass suicide being done quite privately in this huge mansion. I mean, it's very sad that so many people, and again, we don't know what was going on in the brains of these people halfway through maybe going through something like this and going, I don't know if this was the right decision, but shit, I said that I would do it. And now I feel like I'm a fraud if I don't. And I know that there were several people after the fact who thought about doing it themselves. I know that there were a couple of Heaven's Gate members that attempted suicide. They were not successful, thank God. And subsequently have had interviews after the fact of, you know, why they chose to do that or why they felt like they were being left behind. And, you know, they talked about giving these packages out, these VHS packages of former members or, you know, people who they had formerly affiliated with. And among the list of package recipients was this man named Rio D'Angelo. And the package that he received on the evening of March 25th, he received it on the 25th, and other packages contained two VHS videotapes, one with Doe's final exit and the other with the farewell messages of group followers. And it contained a letter stating that, among other things, quote, we have exited our vehicles just as we entered them. And upon informing his boss of the contents of the packages, D'Angelo received a ride from him from Los Angeles right up to the Heaven's Gate home in Rancho Santa Fe so that he could verify the letter. And I believe this is the footage from D'Angelo. If you watch the documentary we were talking about, when he entered the house, he found a back door purposefully left unlocked so that he can get inside. It would allow access. And he used a video camera to record what he found. And after leaving the house, D'Angelo's boss, who had waited outside naturally, encouraged him to make a call to the police, alerting them to the discovery. And the San Diego County Sheriff's Department received an anonymous tip through the 911 system at 3:15 p.m. on March 26th, suggesting that they check on the welfare of the residents. Days after the suicide, the mass suicide, the caller was revealed to be D'Angelo. And it also, the officer said, because of the heat in California, it was very unpleasant going into the home because, again, these suicides didn't happen just in one day. It's not like they discovered them as it happened. This was days after the fact, and decomposition had already begun taking place. And it was a really gross and decrepit sight. Because
happy birthday, Andrew.
And happy birthday.
Also, fun fact, a good friend of ours, uncle, was the first policeman on the site to go in and see what was there. And his only comment was, the smell was horrible.
Yeah. I mean, I've thought about, you know, when you're either reading a book or you're watching a documentary or you're listening to a true crime story and they talk about, you know, decomposition or what it could possibly smell like. I'm often like, you know, I cannot truly imagine. I've smelled dead animal, right? You've been in like a New York City apartment and there's a rat that you happen to find and you're like, what is that smell? A human?
I'm glad it went with a rat. I thought you were going to be like, you know, you're just in a New York City apartment and you're like, ugh, dead body smell. Sure.
But Sarah, what about 39? I literally know people who that's happened to.
I can't.
Totally not. And they'll describe, it's like an unreal smell. So I can't even imagine going into this home of 39 people, all of whom were ultimately cremated, what that could have possibly been like. It's got to be completely unreal, especially for officers who, look, you're used to some shit. You're used to seeing some shit. Right. But in this case, you're kind of like...
It's vodka, dead body, vodka, butterscotch pudding. It's awful. I can hardly think of
not
or what, chocolate not, pudding or
thank God call. That wasn't their dessert at Marie Callender's. I feel like we should also mention to the listeners that when we're talking about the house that they were found in, this isn't a typical house or a home. Rancho Santa Fe is a very, very wealthy neighborhood that are the kind of California mansions that you see on like
The OC and stuff
like that. Like when you watch California television shows like The OC or a 90210 or, you know, I'm really dating myself here, but, you know, or Real Housewives, like this is the kind of neighborhood that we're talking about. We're not talking about 39 bodies in, you know, your grandma's house. It is a luxury mansion.
Dr. Samard?
Yeah, I have a question, and the guests again can go find the whole interview on Patreon, but you mentioned in the interview that the daughter of the owner, I don't know if I'm saying that wrong, threw a Halloween party at this house the following year.
Oh yeah, which
say what you will, I think that's a great way to if you're not going to bulldoze the home, what a great way to reclaim the property, because that's horrifying.
Well, yeah. they did end up bulldozing the home.
Okay, good. That's good.
But before it, they even renamed the street.
Yeah.
So
they renamed the street. They bulldozed the home because they couldn't sell it. I don't know when, how long that they had it was on the market, but the owners of it, the daughter went to my rival high school, and I had a lot of friends who went to that rival high school, and one of them informed us that they had had this, she had this party, probably would have been Halloween 1997, and it got broken up by the cops. And it was just so, it was so funny because I have this friend who's like a few years older than me that was saying that like, that her mom was like, you are not going to that Halloween party. And she was like, mom, I'm not cool enough to get invited to this Halloween party. And then we're talking to Dave, completely unrelated to this high school or anything like that, saying that he had friends who were like, he worked with who went to that party.
Yeah, he was like, yeah, we all went to the party.
Like, he's just, like, I didn't go, but I...
I wouldn't have been old enough at the time, but what... I would have been first in line at that party.
I would have, too. And then my mom would have... I mean, I'm going to just say right here that I would have lied to my mom to go to the party because I did it before in high school. And then my mom subsequently would have found out, which, like, maybe this happened to me in high school. Maybe it didn't, but maybe it did. And then my mom would show up and she would call the home because I didn't have a cell phone. And she would say, be outside in 5 minutes. Like, I don't know, like, maybe this happened to me. And so then I would go outside at the party and my mom would say, get in the car. And I would get in the car. Again, this could be fake or real. And so I get in the car and my mom would say, you are no longer allowed to go to any parties. In fact, you can watch the party happen from your window and you are not allowed to go. Because you know why, Jess? Because everything that you're doing, I've already done it.
So, and take a quick hand raise if you ever heard your mother say a version of that. Me.
Okay, thank God.
It's true. Again, no, like, I'll never forget. I will never forget. I did. I got it in high school. I got the, just so you know, whatever you do, I will know because I have done it.
I've never felt more seen because, again, like, I can't say I've gone to therapy over it, whatever. It's like not a big deal for me. But like, you know, those are the things that when you're like, you really think that you're pulling a fast one. And then mom comes around and she's like, I will never forget that car ride in my entire life because she was like, I've already done everything that you want to do. And I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. Like it was not like we, so I've never done that again. So I would have tried to go to the Halloween party, but again, I was traumatized. And
you gotta find somebody who went to this Halloween party.
Anybody out there, if anyone's listening, we know that we've got a lot of you who have been to the Halloween party or know someone who has.
So guys, do you know the house is presumably a new house is built on that site? Do you know where it is? Have you done a drive-by?
We haven't done a drive-by yet. We could because I haven't been up into that area. Sarah has done a drive-by the Marie Callender's, which is now a Miguel's Cochina Mexican restaurant, which we have also learned is a new structure because the Marie Callender's had a little bit of a feces problem in 2009 where there was a sewage runoff that ran through the server station and they had to close the restaurant and demolish the the spot. So no, there is a new, we can't sit in the booth, because the thing that Dave was great about is he explained exactly where they all sat. But the problem is that now the restaurant doesn't exist anymore. So we can't go sit in Applewhite's booth.
But to answer your question, there is a new house on the lot and the street has been renamed. But it's still
We will let them have their privacy. I'm certainly not going to ask you to take pictures. That would be awful.
Yeah, we don't want to see that.
No, I don't want to traumatize the new owners. Can you imagine? Like, we're the assholes.
I mean, they know.
Can you imagine if we're
they
the assholes that make their lives hell? You know,
like, I know, but also, here's the thing. Like, if you're buying a house in that neighborhood, though, like,
do they know?
I want to tell you something.
I don't know. How could you not?
My mother is a realtor. She's retired, but you do not. There is in real estate. I mean, of course, this was extremely public, so I can't imagine that they wouldn't know. But if there was a suicide in your home, if there was a death, if there was a murder, etc., you do not have to tell anybody buying the home. That is something that remains private. That is, you know, it's not. There are laws where you do not tell people who are making offers on homes, like, and by the way, someone was killed here, or by the way.
But if they ask.
If they ask, yes, you can tell them. But otherwise, not public information. Mm-hmm. Nobody needs to know. And subsequently, if you buy the home and you know, I'm bringing a psychic to every effing home that I decide to go see from now on, who tells me like some shit happened here, then naturally I would ask. But that's not something that you have to disclose.
You don't have to disclose murder, but you do have to disclose bed bugs. That's the world we live in.
Exactly. I mean, could anything be more American?
I mean, I'm going to tell you, as somebody living in New York City, I've dealt with a haunted apartment and bed bugs, and the bed bugs were way worse.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Oh. You can't sage the bed bugs away. They'll still come back.
That's a true story.
But the thing about that, I think if it's like the land, though, I think they probably really don't need to disclose it really at all, even if they ask. It's just the land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just the land. You know, and again, like it depends on the buyer. It depends on who, you know, what they want, the information that they need to know, whether or not it's important. And again, I would assume that anybody going to buy this lot, which would be, you know, many hundreds, thousands, $5.75 worth of monies in order to buy the lot, you would know because of every news story that has happened and because Rancho Santa Fe is probably very well known for the fact that this took place, that there was a mass suicide.
I want to clarify that I did not grow up in one of these massive houses. It was a very nicely, moderately sized house. I just want to clarify that I was not just crazy rich.
Oh, okay. So listeners, now that you know that, judge him appropriately about that.
Right. We're going to give you a parting. We're going to send you pudding as a parting gift for being here today. Thank you.
A little cozy shack rice pudding.
Thank you so much.
An applesauce.
Seriously, you got. Hi, my friends. It's so nice to see your faces.
Friends.
Miss you.
Yeah. Miss you too.
Thank you for being here and chatting and doing that interview. And if you have any subsequent things that come your way, you know, send them our way because we're obsessed.
Listen, and I hope that when you pass a pair of black Nikes, you just, you know, have a little nod to good old Doe and T.
One must. And one must for the rest of their lives when they watch The Sound of Music. That's it.
Well, bye, you guys.
I love you.
Love you.
So fantastic.
Yeah.
So fantastic.
So sweet, right? They are the best. They've been longtime friends. Love them so much.
What a wonderful addition to telling this story. I think that, you know, all of you killers who we love so very much, who join us every single week, we hope that you enjoyed this episode. We thank you so much for listening. Again, you can find the entire interview with Dave Riley of Marie Callender's on the Patreon page. And until next time, keep killing it.
Don't kill anyone.
Killers, go to our Patreon page and join us to get exclusive bonus content and follow us on Instagram at Killing It On Broadway and Twitter at Killing It On B-Way.
Subscribe to us for free wherever you download your podcasts.
And go ahead and give us a 5-star rating and a lovely review. It'll be good for you.
Killing It On Broadway is a production of Killing It On Broadway, LLC.
Music by Mary Mitchell Campbell. Orchestrations, Benedict Braxton Smith.
Edited and engineered by Smokey.
Morale officers, Fred and Nelson. Say goodbye, Fred.
Say goodbye, Nelson.